Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 727, Whither China. This is being recorded on October 24th of the year 2010. We have been taking a look at the awarding of the Nobel Peace Prize to a Chinese, quote, dissident, unquote, named Liu Xiaobo. Liu Xiaobo is someone who had been particularly favored for the receipt of this prize by the Federal Republic of Germany, which not incidentally is China's number one rival for the world's position of the world's number one economic exporting power. And as such, Germany literally has a lot to gain from the decline of the People's Republic of China. As we looked at in the first side of this program, the real demand, or the Charter 08 of Liu Xiaobo, basically calls for the radical privatization of China in keeping with the most fundamental free market doctrines. Free market doctrines which are indeed being challenged worldwide. And in particular, one of the aspects of this free market, quote, reform, unquote, that Liu Xiaobo is proposing for China involves the reversal of the land reform, which had been fundamental to the alleviation of starvation and some of the grinding social inequalities that had beset China for such a long time. As such, the program of Liu Xiaobo is basically going to resonate with the Chinese people about as effectively and sympathetically as the notion of the United States becoming a British colony or some sort of similar fundamental social and political and historical reversal of a country's system, and in so doing, in reversing that system, a fundamental compromise of that country's territorial sovereignty and its political sovereignty as well. We're going to jump right back in where we left off with an article that was written just after Liu Xiaobo got the Nobel Peace Prize. It's called The Federal Republic of China, and it will sum up and reiterate much of what we looked at in Side 2. Skipping down in the article, the Charter 08 is heading in the opposite direction, demanding a complete privatization in the midst of a global economic crisis in which public acceptance for the neoclassical economic models is internationally declining. The authors of Charter 08 are in line with the wishes of Western companies expanding to China and pleading continuously for a lifting of limitations, especially those on the foreign ownership of property. Going far beyond these demands, Charter 08 is calling for a reversal of the land reform and privatization of land ownership. The land reform, which has been proceeding through several phases since 1950, initially expropriated the land of the large landowners and war criminals and reapportioned their estates to peasants and medium-sized farmers. The collectivization carried out since the mid-1950s, where the farmers formed cooperatives and people's communes, has been reversed to a large extent since the end of the 1970s. Today, Chinese farmers are free to decide whether they want to conduct their business privately or in the form of a cooperative or a collective. The nationalization of the land currently in force, the furthest reaching measure of the land reform, has been carried out only since the end of the 1950s. Since that time, all land, including land on which farmers have built and planted their lives, their crops, and to which they enjoy special hereditary concessions, is being leased from the state. The Charter 08, being praised in Berlin, explicitly demands the reprivatization of the land. With the exception of possible juridical and practical procedure, the land that poor peasants and medium-sized farmers have been working for 60 years is to be taken away and redistributed. How that is to be done justly is not explained in the document. In their consequences, the Charter 08 demands would essentially mean a complete revision of the Chinese Constitution, the breakup of the People's Republic itself, and the establishment of a Federal Republic of China, unquote. The essential revisions have less to do with freedom of expression or democracy than with the political economic order. Contrary to all Chinese tradition, political centralism is to be abolished. Together with Hong Kong and Macau, whose political systems must be preserved, a federative, constituted Federal Republic of China is to be erected. For thousands of years, China has had a centralized state. As far back as the Qin Dynasty, 2,500 years ago, uniformed systems of measurements and weights, a common currency, as well as a state system centralized around an imperial capital and an emperor had been developed. All subsequent political systems, including the various imperial dynasties, the National Bourgeois Republic of China of 1911, as well as the People's Republic of China itself, have maintained the orientation of centrally administering this enormous country with its dozens of national entities and provinces. The demand of federalization is oriented on the system in the Federal Republic of Germany, among others, without these models being explicitly mentioned. Charter 08 does not answer the question of how a country with 1.44 billion citizens stretched across such an enormous territory should be federatively administered and simultaneously maintained as a nation state. This last section here is noted quite effectively and pointedly. Freedom to overthrow China. The German chancellor, in consonance with all of the Western heads of state, has been intervening on the behalf of Liu Xiaobo, who is serving his prison sentence for calling for the overthrow of the People's Republic of China. Berlin, which is not particularly known for its sympathy toward any possible domestic plans for subversion in Germany, is demanding Liu Xiaobo's liberation. The Charter 08 program has been translated into German and reviewed more often in Germany since Liu's nomination for the Nobel Peace Prize was made public. It is sure that this document will receive wide-ranging attention from leading media organs, providing the anti-Chinese agitators in Germany a new element for use in future campaigns to weaken their political rival in Beijing, campaigns such as that run during the run-up to the Olympics in 2008. Well, again, one of the things to be seen here, one of the things in which to view this, is the very real necessity of having China behave as a somewhat more mature international citizen, particularly with regard to letting its currency rise and with regard to being less idiosyncratic and cynical vis-a-vis foreign policy in places like Africa and the Middle East. Nonetheless, if there continue to be attempts at actually breaking up China or dictating to the Chinese how they should run their own country, I think that can only push China in the opposite direction and ultimately could result in some very, very serious and ultimately catastrophic situations indeed. In this regard, we're going to take a look at one of the sections of China that's been very restive, Xinjiang, China. That is inhabited in considerable measure by the Uyghurs. Those are a Muslim people. They are Turkophonic. That is to say their language is very similar to Turkish. They are one of the groups of peoples that have been envisioned as part of the Pan-Turkist movement, and their inclusion into an East Turkestan was part of a foreign policy gambit that had been undertaken by pre-World War II anti-Soviet networks. It had then been undertaken by the Third Reich, and in the post-World War II period, it had been undertaken by many Western intelligence services, including German, American, and British. In For the Record program 720, 721, and 723, we took a look at the Pan-Turkist movement, and in particular recent developments vis-a-vis the Pan-Turkist movement. We're going to review Xinjiang, or East Turkestan, as the Uyghurs call it. Bear in mind that the Dalai Lama has been very sympathetic to the attempts at gaining independence for Xinjiang on behalf of the Uyghurs. Bear in mind that the UNPO has been very active on behalf of the Uyghurs and Xinjiang independence. Bear in mind that Xinjiang is very rich in natural resources. It is very rich in gold, oil, natural gas, among other resources. There has been a considerable degree of focus in recent weeks on China's very pivotal position with regard to rare earth elements, which are essential for high-tech and, in particular, high-tech military applications. Xinjiang is one of the areas where the rare earth elements are to be found in considerable abundance. And so attempts at gaining the secession of Xinjiang, China, or the independence of Xinjiang, China, are not going to sit well with the Chinese. Following article, The Future of East Turkestan, from July 7th of 2009. Berlin is using the riots in the Xinjiang region in western China to launch strong attacks against Beijing. Claudia Roth, chairperson of the German Green Party, is demanding that the People's Republic initiate speedy and unconditional investigations into the bloody conflicts. Influential media in Germany are declaring Beijing's minorities policy to be a, quote, failure, unquote, saying that China is confronted with an explosion, unquote. Uyghur separatists, who, with their anti-Han pogrom, started the bloody riots last weekend, have maintained close ties to Germany for years. Their Munich-based representative, the World Uyghur Congress, has been active winning support for Uyghur secessionist policy. During its last General Assembly held last May in Washington, the organization planned its next steps. They also have the ear of the German Foreign Ministry. The World Uyghur Congress had called for anti-Beijing demonstrations preceding these riots, and according to Chinese reports, the Congress is behind last week's bloody violence. At least 150 people died in last weekend's riots in Urumqi, capital of China's northwest Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region. Tensions had been growing for quite some time in that region. In September, Uyghur separatists were planning protests for the 60th anniversary of Xinjiang's reintegration into the People's Republic of China. The Turkic-speaking Uyghur are a Muslim minority living in Xinjiang. Some of them are striving to merge Xinjiang as East Turkestan with other Turkic-language territories in Central Asia and consider its secession from the People's Republic of China a prerequisite. The tensions in Xinjiang had intensified at the end of June when two Uyghurs were killed in the violent conflict that erupted between Uyghurs and other Chinese in southern China. Last weekend, Uyghurs started an anti-Chinese pogrom in Urumqi, attacking non-Uyghurs, their homes, and their cars with clubs, stones, and knives. It is not known how many non-Uyghurs were killed during the pogroms and how many Uyghurs died at the hands of Chinese security forces who were suppressing the riots. An organization based in Munich, the World Uyghur Congress, is escalating tensions and most likely is also behind the calls for last week's ethnic pogroms. This organization is directing the Uyghurs living in exile in the West. It held its third General Assembly at the end of May in Washington. In this context, it, in cooperation with the U.S. American National Endowment for Democracy, also organized a human rights conference, unquote, focusing on solutions for the future of East Turkestan, unquote. A representative for the German Society for Threatened Peoples, or Gesellschaft für bedrohte Völker, were listed among the speakers. The participation of U.S. parliamentarians at the event was very motivating for these very same Uyghur separatists. Subsequently, at the beginning of July, the World Uyghur Congress called for demonstrations in front of Chinese embassies around the world under the pretext of protesting the deaths of two Uyghurs during the conflict in late June in southern China. According to the Chinese Xinhua News Agency, the calls for the demonstrations were followed by appeals via Internet to be braver and to do something big, unquote, catchwords that can be understood as a veiled instigation to violent action in Beijing. The World Uyghur Congress draws on decades of anti-Chinese, German, and U.S. cooperation. One of the founders of this organization is the prominent secessionist Erkin Alptekin, whose family is held in high esteem in Uyghur circles, by the way, and also by the Dalai Lama. Continuing, he moved to Munich in 1971, where he became a senior policy advisor, unquote, to the director of the U.S. Radio Liberty. It was at that time that the CIA began to establish contacts to Uyghurs seeking secession. Some, like Erkin Alptekin, who have worked for the CIA's Radio Liberty, are, in the meantime, on the forefront of the secessionist movement, writes analyst B. Rahman, the Indian government's former cabinet secretary. Alptekin became the founding president of the World Uyghur Congress established in Munich in April of 2004, which, according to Beijing, has ties to terrorist milieu, plural. By the way, among those terrorist milieu are the Muslim Brotherhood. Continuing, Alptekin's successor, Rebya Kadir, who at the end of the 1990s was the richest businesswoman in the People's Republic of China, has been living in exile in the United States since November of 2005. In November of 2006, she was elected president of the World Uyghur Congress in Munich and at this occasion visited Berlin for the first time. Only a year later, in October of 2007, she met with representatives of German party-affiliated foundations and the German Bundestag's Human Rights Committee, in addition to holding talks with the German Foreign Ministry. She is being systematically groomed to become the Uyghur PR overseas symbol, corresponding to the model of the Dalai Lama appealing for the sympathy for Tibetan separatism. Rebya Kadir, the mother of the Uyghurs, unquote, has been proposed several times already as a candidate for the Nobel Peace Prize. By the way, this article is from 09. Her biography was introduced in the German National Press Conference, receiving the German media's attention at the time. The German media points with interest to the fact that Xinjiang, the region threatened by secessionists, is very significant to China. It constitutes a geostrategic bridgehead to Central Asia and is very rich in mineral resources. In particular, extensive oil and natural gas deposits are believed to be in Xinjiang, as well as gold and uranium. And parenthetically, I would add the much recently publicized rare earth elements. But above all, the Uyghur secessionists are in no way acting in isolation. Alongside their contacts to Western government circles, they also maintain close ties to the secessionists of the autonomous regions of Tibet and Inner Mongolia. "Our three peoples are linked through geography, history, and more recently also Chinese occupation," claimed the Dalai Lama in the late 1990s. "I remain optimistic that in the not-too-distant future, the true aspirations of the peoples of East Turkestan, Inner Mongolia, and Tibet will be fulfilled," unquote. The sympathy Berlin feels toward the Uyghur secessionists is based on hopes that the strategic rival, the People's Republic of China, could be seriously weakened by the loss of an enormous amount of territory leading from Tibet to Xinjiang to Inner Mongolia. By the way, bear in mind, too, that the head, at least for a long time and perhaps still, the head of the State Department's Tibet desk was Paula Dobryansky, the daughter of Leb Dobryansky, very close to the OUNB and the Galen anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations, Third Reich emigre milieu that I've looked at, that we've looked at for so many years here on these programs. Lev Dobryansky was involved with the martial law, the development of martial law contingency plans in this country, and is part and parcel to the milieu of the OUNB. The late Dobryansky's daughter Paula is the head, or was for a long time, and perhaps is still the head of the State Department's Tibet desk. Reviewing another GermanForeignPolicy.com article about Tibetan attempts at basically affecting secession from China. This is called Smash China. It is from November 19th of 2008. It reads in part, "At a conference of more than 600 exiled Tibetans that began Monday at the seat of Tibet's self-proclaimed exile government in Dharamsala, India, a longtime employee of the Heinrich Boll Foundation, affiliated with Germany's Green Party, was demanding a radicalization of the Tibetan secessionist policy. This meeting will decide on the Tibetan secessionist strategy for the next few years. The Berlin-based Green-affiliated activists demanded that the Tibet movement no longer formally be fighting for autonomy, but rather for the secession of this territory. In Dharamsala, this demand is becoming more popular. In spite of unambiguous radicalization tendencies, several German politicians and political organizations, for example, the party-affiliated foundations of the Green Party and the Free Democratic Party, are maintaining their contacts to the Tibetan exile institutions and supporting their structures. The Heinrich Boll Foundation explains that its presence and capacity to moderate, unquote, is important precisely because of a threatening escalation. German participation in future conflicts taking place in Western China will therefore be assured. Tsewang Norbu, a longtime employee of the Heinrich Boll Foundation, raised the demand during the current conference of over 600 Tibetan exiles at the seat of the self-proclaimed Tibetan government in exile in Dharamsala, India. By the way, parenthetically, in For the Record 547, we took a look at one of the people who was viewed by favor by that Tibetan government in exile, an associate, a friend of the Dalai Lama's, and that basically was the SS anthropologist who had been the SS anthropologist on the SS Tibetan expedition in 1938, and who later had some 120 Soviet prisoners of, quote, Asiatic, unquote, body type killed with cyanide spray for subsequent dissection and research on, quote, Asiatic body types, unquote. That individual, an honored associate of the Dalai Lama. More about the Tibetan government in exile in Dharamsala, India. The conference was convened by the Tibetan's political religious leader, the Dalai Lama, to discuss the strategy of the secessionist movement. Up to now, the Dalai Lama has always officially declared that he would be satisfied with an extensive autonomy within the People's Republic of China and has engaged in negotiations with government officials in Beijing on that basis. Just a few weeks ago, he announced a breakdown in that negotiating strategy. This creates a realm for those who seek a more aggressive policy and openly call for Tibet's secession from China. This group includes the followers of the Tibetan People's Uprising Movement, founded in 2008, and also those of the older 30,000-member Tibetan Youth Congress, which, according to its statutes, pledges, quote, to struggle for the total independence of Tibet even at the cost of one's life, unquote. Tsewang Norbu, who spoke the future strategy of the exile government in Dharamsala, wields a lot of weight in the exile Tibetan community. A resident of West Germany since 1973, at the side of the Green parliamentarian Petra Kelly, he developed during the mid-1980s the Green Party's policy toward Tibet, and was hired by the Heinrich Böll Foundation in 1992. Norbu founded the German-Tibetan Cultural Society and was also active in the Tibet Initiative Deutschland and is one of the original German supporters for the Tibetan exile in Dharamsala. Norbus's position is also being propagated among sympathizers in Germany. As Norbu writes, following the breakdown of negotiations between the Dalai Lama and the Chinese government, the Tibetan exile has, quote, to come back to square one, unquote. The Tibetans as a people have this right to self-determination, and we should not forfeit this right. Norbu is convinced, unquote, that the majority of the Tibetans in Tibet still retain a strong commitment to full independence for Tibet, unquote. According to Norbu, only the Dalai Lama could have won the Tibetans over to accepting autonomy within the territorial boundaries of the People's Republic of China. When he dies, no Tibetan leadership will be able to hold back the population from their striving for secession. Norbu therefore called on all participants at the Dharamsala conference to radicalize the policy of the exile government and to struggle for complete independence, in other words, to smash China. According to Norbu, deficits in the political structures in Dharamsala have prohibited a parliamentary debate on a radicalization of policy. In a parliamentary democracy, you have a ruling party or coalition and an opposition party or parties, writes the activist. We don't have that. Therefore, the demand for a radical secessionist policy is also not being raised by a strong opposition and must be pushed at the current Dharamsala conference. But the former Green Party member does not want his remarks about the absence of parties in an opposition in the Tibetan exile parliament, unquote, to be mistaken as a criticism of principle. I am not implying that a multi-party parliamentary system per se is better than a one- or no-party parliamentary system. The tendencies toward radicalization in Dharamsala, which could lead the exile government to take on a new course, are being closely observed in Germany. Particularly young exile Tibetans who grew up in India obviously tend toward carrying out protest actions, unquote, reports the Indian office of the Heinrich Böll Foundation. Since 2008, young leaders in the exile Tibetan community have been using a new rhetoric and even new political tactics, unquote. In reference to those exile Tibetans who, disrupting the Olympic torch relay this spring with violent actions, the foundation writes, quote, they are placing to a growing extent the unconditional commitment to nonviolence into question and are seeking new forms of resistance. According to articles in the German press, their objectivity is evidently to drive up the costs of occupation, unquote, for the Chinese government. By the way, in our recent series of programs about WikiLeaks, we took a look at that Chinese dissidents, unquote, being at the foundation of the formation of WikiLeaks and the fact that WikiLeaks was basically aiming their activities, among other things, at, quote, totalitarian, unquote, regimes in the Earth Island, China and Russia, and some of the former, quote, stands, unquote, from the former Soviet Union in particular. Concluding this particular story, German politicians and political organizations are closely accompanying the developments in Dharamsala. Above all, the Heinrich Böll Foundation and the Friedrich Naumann Foundation are supporting the Tibetan exile institutions from their base in New Delhi. The Hessian Prime Minister Roland Koch entertains a close relationship with the Dalai Lama. And by the way, in that regard, I would also note that the North Tyrol independence movement and other more or less openly Nazi movements associated with the Vertriebene groups have also been used as advisory elements for the Tibetan and Uyghur independence movements. One of the things to note here is that even as German NGOs and other German political institutions, as well as American NGOs and political institutions, are providing something of a venue for a more militant approach on the part of Tibetan exiles, some of these very same institutions in Germany are also at the same time positioning themselves to be mediators between the increasingly militant and potentially violent people who are receiving, to a certain extent, encouragement from these very same institutions, then basically in sort of a let's you and him fight and now let's make peace scenario, some of these same institutions are positioning themselves to be mediators in the very future conflicts they're helping to precipitate. Returning once again to the Smash Charna article from GermanForeignPolicy.com, whereas the Naumann Foundation is dealing with the exile parliament and the reinforcement of democratic institutions in Dharamsala, the Böll Foundation, for example, uses the Tibetan Center for Conflict Resolution, an organization that is supposed to mediate between the antagonists. Particularly in the case of a possible change of strategy to a more radical policy, it is very important to maintain intensive contacts to the organizations in Dharamsala, according to the program director of the Böll Foundation. He makes a plea to the Tibetan Center for Conflict Resolution that is supported by his organization to broaden it to activities to include mediation in upcoming political conflicts with more radical forces such as the Tibetan Youth Congress. The president of the foundation declared that it is necessary to prevent any sort of misguidance, unquote, thereby justifying an intensification of German activities in an increasingly inflamed exile Tibetan milieu. It seems a certainty that in the coming conflicts in western China, German organizations will be playing no insignificant role. This will provide Berlin with influence in several Chinese provinces, thereby weakening its rival while reinforcing the German geopolitical position. The German Green Party Foundation dissociates itself from its employee, Tsewang Norbu, who is calling for smashing the People's Republic of China. Norbu is an activist in exile Tibetan organizations. For some time, he's been presenting himself as an employee of the foundation both in the press and in public announcements of his appearances. So again, in terms of evaluating this, and again, this is not in any way to hold a brief or to excuse Chinese cynicism or transgressions domestically or abroad, but from a practical standpoint, there is no country, including the U.S. and Germany, that would tolerate this sort of interference in its internal affairs. And I think the Chinese in particular, with their sensitivity toward their colonial past, they can only be expected to arch their back in a very determined fashion when this sort of activity is presented, arranged against them. And ultimately, I don't think that that is going to do anything but promote chaos on the international scene. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 727, Wither China. This program is being recorded on October 24th of the year 2010. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.